Hi, everyone. It's great to see all of you. We've set up a lot of extra chairs for all the extra people that came last week. So the room's a little bit stretched out, so I hope that everyone can hear me. May need to make sure that everyone's especially quiet to help ensure that everyone can hear me. So along those lines, just ask everyone to make sure to remember to turn your cell phones at least on to vibrate so that they don't go off to the class. Continuing before we start off the class with our announcements that we always like to make at the beginning, that's to remind you about next year. The Tanakh question on this past year, it totally beat our expectations. It really blew us away. I think really made a great impact on our community, started changing a culture of learning and growing and of exploration. So for those of you who haven't had the opportunity or haven't taken advantage of the opportunity of going to Tanakh B'Shana, we're going to do it again next year. And I can't say more and give more encouragement to taking the class, that it's going to be a wonderful experience. You're not going to regret it. You're really going to be very much so enriched by the opportunity. For those of you that have taken Tanakh already, we're going forward. We're continuing to break new ground, curriculum-based adult education. With Sfarim B'Shana, we're going to be going through all the major works of the past 2,000 years in areas of Jewish law, philosophy, biblical interpretation, and we're going to be covering over 20 books or so. We're going to be having excellent educators. Dr. Lauren Schiffman from NYU is going to be involved, is helping direct the course. It's going to be fantastic. It's really going to set a new mark. We already have tons of people registered for the class. We're definitely online to even beat this past year's numbers for Tanakh B'Shana. So take advantage. Sign up for one of the classes. There's forms outside if you want to take, either fill out now or just take home and fill out later and bring it to the office. We even have already the schedules for the classes. You can see the exact dates also. Those are available outside. We'd be happy to help you with that after class. Okay, but on to tonight. The series that we're doing right now, we call it Between Tanakh and Sfarim B'Shana. It's a double entendre. It's both scheduling-wise, between our Tanakh B'Shana course and our Sfarim B'Shana course, but more importantly, it's thematically between Tanakh and Sfarim B'Shana. Tanakh being written to the point of something we discussed a little bit last week when discussing the Apocrypha. The close of Tanakh is sometime likely in the 3rd century before the Common Era, and we start thinking about Sfarim, the works of Chazal, the works of our rabbis. That's already talking about the 2nd, 3rd century of the Common Era. So we're looking at a 400, 500 year period between the books that we consider to be holy, books that we consider to be part of our religious tradition. But that doesn't mean that there wasn't much being written during that time period. People didn't simply, it wasn't a period of a dark ages. It was a time where books have not been incorporated into our lexicon, shall we say, of Jewish literature, but there was much writing that was done, and a lot of writing that is important to Jewish knowledge, certainly from a historical vantage point, in the way that it certainly teaches us simply about the history of that time period, but also it gives us an inkling into the history of our own tradition, and in doing so gives us a better understanding of Judaism as it was then, but ultimately how it is practiced today and how it's understood today, both on a theological level as well as on a religious, practical, halakhic, legal level as well. And so we've been looking at these types of books. Last week we looked at the Apocrypha. Now that we're halfway through, I can actually tell you with certainty how it's going to work. Tonight we're going to be looking at Josephus. We'll talk about that more in a moment. Next week we're going to be doing the Dead Sea Scrolls, which should be a lot of fun. And the final week we're going to be doing something, a book which probably, I would say, of all of the titles that we've used, probably the one that you is least heard of, but is actually quite important and it'll be interesting, and that's Megillat Ta'anit, the Fast Scrolls. And so when we get to that, we'll talk about those. But all of these books are written primarily during this Second Temple, during this Bayit Sheni period, or directly post Bayit Sheni, just directly past the destruction of the Second Temple. And while they're not part of our canon of religious books, they certainly are important for our understanding of Judaism. So what I want to talk about tonight is Josephus. You can buy it in the store, probably thinner than this. I think they know how to make paper, maybe thinner now than they used to. So you can get a little bit of a more handable copy in the stores today. But it's a very large work. This is small print, and there's a lot that Josephus wrote. And we're going to talk about. I want to focus on what he wrote more than on the person. That's something that is going to one of the things that's interesting about the course we're doing next year on Sfarim Bashana is that we're focusing on Sfarim. We're going to be focusing on books, how to use the books, what's contained in them, what's unique about them, what exactly do we learn from them. In doing so, we'll talk about the authors, who wrote them, why did they write them, what was the historical context for what brought about their being written, but the focus ultimately is on the books themselves and what they contain, because that ultimately is what has lasting impact on the Jewish people more than the author is what the author wrote. And so tonight I want to focus on the book, I want to focus on what's inside, but to do so we're going to have a little bit of a discussion of Josephus as well, but I'm not going to spend so much time on Josephus because you also cannot read what it says in Encyclopedia Judaica. You don't just have to have me spit it back to you. So I'll have a little bit of a discussion of some things that I've learned from some of those readings, but really then I want to get into some studies that you may not have come across just from reading what it says in Encyclopedia. Perhaps some more in-depth studies, but particularly one of the things that we're doing within this course is that these books are studied from many different vantage points. I got a lot of the text that's in the source sheets of Josephus from a website called Text of Christianity. I'm not sure why Josephus is considered a text of Christianity. There may be some references to Jesus at some point or another, but these are Jewish texts, or these are texts that relate to the Jewish people, certainly much more than they do to Christianity. So what I want to do is to study these books from our unique vantage point, coming from a community that celebrates Judaism, that celebrates Torah study, to study these works for their contribution to Jewish knowledge and to Jewish learning, which is perhaps slightly different than simply looking at it as a purely historical document. There's actually much more that they contribute. So when we think about Josephus, we think about the person, but we think about his work, we think about his writings. And Josephus wrote a number of different writings, and we're going to talk about what each of them are. We'll put them into context of the life of Josephus, what sort of brought about the writing of these different books. But there's really four books that he wrote, two of which are the most prominent, two of which are the most meaty, that make up the vast majority of the pages within this volume. Just, you can look at, as much as I do, on your cover sheet, that there's four primary works that he wrote. Perhaps the two most famous are the first two. The Wars of the Jews. We're going to look at that. That's a historical look at the wars of the Romans against the people of Judea, and ultimately culminating in the destruction of Bayit Sheni, destruction of Jerusalem. We're going to really look at that at the end. It's timely as we find ourselves in 3 weeks. And that will sort of get a sense of, you know, why Josephus is so important, even simply from a historical vantage point to us as Jews who very much so continue to remember the past. And then going on, he wrote another work called The Antiquities of the Jews. That's somewhat of a polemical work, and so that's an interesting book to look at. That's looking at not just the history within a certain time period, but it's looking at the entire history of the Jewish people, going back to creation, going through the stories of the Bible. It's interesting to see the way that he portrays those stories, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And going through, again, all the way up until the end of the Second Temple period, until the time that he's alive. There's then two smaller works that he wrote. One of them is called The Life of Josephus. That's a defense. And we'll talk about exactly what he's defending as we get a little bit better sense about who Josephus really was. And then finally, a work against Appian, which is also a polemic, though of a slightly different nature than that of Antiquities of the Jews. And we'll have a chance to sort of look into that a little bit as we go forward. And so Josephus wrote these works. Some have suggested that his these two works, Wars of the Jews and Antiquities of the Jews, were in fact perhaps some of the most widely read writings during that time period within the Roman Empire. It's not simply that he's made it through all these years just because, but these were great works. You read them, there's a literary flair to them. They're engaging. I've not read the whole thing, it's huge. But you read through it, he clearly had a literary style and caught people's attention. And it's interesting that these works did become so widely read. And I, in part, wonder whether or not, and I haven't seen this written anywhere, that perhaps this really almost led the groundwork for the ability of Christianity to be so widely accepted ultimately within the Roman Empire, because perhaps people already were somewhat aware of Judaism, of monotheism within a pagan culture because of the writings of Josephus. So he really did disseminate not only the history of the Jews, but the religion of the Jewish people as well. And so it's an important work at the time that it was written, and it's very important 2,000 years later because of the window that it opens for us into that time period. Taking into consideration Josephus himself and perhaps therefore certain aspects of the writings that we may not take as seriously as others, again taking into consideration who the author was and perhaps certain objectives that he may personally have had in what he wrote. Okay, so before we get into them and really start getting into the meat of them, who was Josephus? I think we've heard his name before and we have some idea of Josephus, but in fact, getting a little bit of his background, getting a little bit of an understanding of who he was, of his life, will give you an even more precise or more awareness, a greater awareness of what he wrote, a greater appreciation of what it is that he really wrote. So, where does it start? He's born in the Common Era. He's born in 38 of the Common Era. He's born in Yerushalayim. He's born to a family of Kohanim, of a priestly family. He's part of the aristocracy, as typically priests were at that time. And in fact, he seems to even come a descendant from the Maccabean dynasty. When we think about the history of Bayit Sheni, so for most of the time of Bayit Sheni, we're under a foreign government. We're first under the Persians, and then ultimately under the Greeks. And that goes until 165 BCE, when the Maccabees revolt, and we then under the Maccabean dynasty all the way till the times of Herod, when the Romans ultimately come in and conquer Judea. And so there is that period of the Maccabean dynasty. We celebrate the Maccabees on Hanukkah. So when we think of the Maccabees, we think great. So when you think of the Maccabean dynasty, you think not so great. They didn't necessarily continue along the same lines as the great Maccabees that we celebrate on Hanukkah. But when we think of the Second Temple period of Bayit Sheni, that was a great time. I mean, we were in charge of our own destiny. And so to be a part of the descendants of the Maccabees, that was something to be proud of. It certainly meant that you came from a certain leadership position, that was on his mother's side. So that was something that he was proud of. So he's born at that time period. It seems that he goes through a little bit of a religious searching. We're going to talk about this more next week when we talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls. But he talks about his search that he had looking at the different Jewish communities that existed at that time. I want to just look at one source that we see now. It's going to be important for later on. If you open your source book to page to the sources, we're going to look at where Josephus writes a little bit about himself. Just before we read that, I'll just draw your attention to what you find on the inside of the cover, and that's basically the outline of the books themselves. Just thought you might want to see. Shows you what's in Wars of the Jews, what's in Antiquities of the Jews. These are obviously just headings of the chapters. It looks very historical, but within the chapters, he gets into a lot of other things, as we're going to see during the class. But just for your information, you can take a look and see sort of the way that he breaks up his book. But look at source number two. We'll talk about source number one a little bit later. And I'm going to skip down. Go to the end of the fourth line in source number two. He says over there, he says, "And I made a mighty proficiency in the improvements of my learning, and appeared to have both great memory and understanding. Moreover, when I was a child, and about 14 years of age, I was commended by all for the love I had to learning, on which account the high priests and principal men of the city came then frequently to me together in order to know my opinion about the accurate understandings of points of the law." And so Josephus says about himself, "I grew up in a family of learning. I was knowledgeable. In fact, I excelled in my learning." It very well could be. He clearly is a talented person to have written these books. It's no surprise that maybe he was quite talented. There's a question, and we'll talk about it later as we look at some of the sources, as, well, how learned was he really? And some who question his knowledge of Torah. But at least he claims, something at least that he wants to take pride in, and shows sort of the things that he does take pride in, the fact that he talks about that, hey, this is something that I had achieved. The paragraph continues and talks about sort of his spiritual wandering for a few year period, but ultimately concludes with the fourth to last line that line. It says that, "So when I had accomplished my desires," meaning when I went and I sort of looked around, "I returned back to the city, being now 19 years old, and began to conduct myself according to the rules of the sect of the Pharisees, which is of the kin to the sect of the Stoics, as the Greeks call them." And so he ultimately says, "I align myself with the Purushim, with the Pharisees," which is important for us because the Pharisees are the hairbringer of the what we call the rabbis, right? Of rabbinic Judaism, as it's referred to, perhaps incorrectly or somewhat negatively within the academic community, but meaning into our tradition of the way that we understand the Torah to be observed. He aligns himself with that community, and that's borne out, again, somewhat debated among scholars, but that's more or less borne out through the books that he writes, that was part of the Purushim, that was the way of understanding the Torah that he did believe in. And so that's his childhood. That's sort of how he grows up.
What line did he write, Aramaic?
That's a question. And that sort of impacts exactly who his audience was for the books. It depends which book. Some are in Aramaic, some are originally written in Greek. They're ultimately all translated into Greek, even ones originally in Aramaic, but it does give you a sense of, you know, who's his audience. If he's writing it in Greek, then he's writing it for the broader, you know, society. If he's writing in Aramaic, it could be that it's directed a little bit more at the Jewish community. Could be originally writes things in Aramaic maybe because it's easier for him, and maybe it's not necessarily a sign that it was directly at the Jewish community, but more just maybe that was language he was more familiar with. But clearly he is familiar with Greek. He is knowledgeable in Greek because of his writings, and that could explain an important point that happens in the life of in his life. We know that at the age of 26, he goes to Rome. He goes to Rome as part of a group of, I believe it's a group of Kohanim that are going to Rome in order to try to win the freedom of other Kohanim who've been taken captive by the Romans. And so, who knows what that experience of being in Rome, perhaps seeing the city of Rome, being surrounded by, maybe that ultimately impacted some of his decisions that he has later in his life. But again, it sort of shows you, well, if he was chosen to do it, he must have been someone of prominence, and that he must have been someone who they felt was capable of conversing, of negotiating with the Roman leadership.
the Roman leadership was both Greek, or was there another language?
I think at that point was probably Greek. I'm not sure. I don't know the history of language. Is it Latin already? So I don't know. I don't know the history of so much as far as that's concerned.
Who appointed him as a historian?
Sorry?
Who appointed him as a historian?
Oh, so we'll get to that. We'll get to that. So right now, he hasn't written anything, right? He hasn't written anything. He's just a guy. In 66 of the Common Era, the Romans are finally really marching their way down. They are going to conquer Judea. That it's not simply going to be a state sort of within a state, but they are going to conquer Judea and take complete control over these Jews who keep sort of trying to start up and regain their independence, regain their glory days of the Maccabees. He's given a very important position within the army. So again, it gives you a sense about the faith that people must have had in him. He's given the role of being the commander of the legions of the Galil. So think about the geography. It's certainly the first point of the war. That's the most important position. That's the first line of defenses against the Romans, is the northern border of Israel. So he's given command over that post. In 67 of that Common Era, just a year later, his efforts crumble. They lose. Seems that he runs away to a cave with certain people that survive. They make some kind of pact to commit suicide. They draw lots. His lot is the second to last person to do it. Everybody else, I don't know, they help kill each other. They kill themselves. Him and another guy are left. At that point, they decide, we're not killing ourselves. And they go ahead and they give themselves up to the Romans at that time period. He's taken prisoner by Rome. And we're going to talk about what exactly happens at that point. But at that point forward, he's a prisoner. He's a prisoner of Rome. We'll talk about why they don't kill him, why exactly he's left to live, or at least according to his accounts, for why that takes place. And he then follows the armies, first under Vespasian, and then ultimately, when Vespasian is made Roman emperor, under Titus. As Titus makes his way down to conquer Jerusalem, he's down. He follows along with the army, and he witnesses the destruction of Jerusalem. In fact, it seems he even tried to help negotiate a settlement where he tries to encourage the Jews of Jerusalem to put down their arms, to surrender. It seems that perhaps that was not looked upon so favorably by other Jews. And sort of brings about this attitude towards Josephus. We think about Josephus, we think about him as maybe a great historian, but from a Jewish perspective, there's sort of this attitude that a lot of people have, which is negative towards Josephus, that he's a traitor, that maybe he helped the Romans, that he maybe, you know, he didn't fight his hardest within battle. Ultimately, he goes ahead and writes for the Romans. Right, negative, that he's not someone that we necessarily look upon favorably. As we'll see, the flip side is that maybe, no, he's a very proud Jew, and he lost in battle, and he did what he needed to do to survive. Maybe some of the things that he wrote were because he had no choice that he wrote them. And sort of the opposite view is that he wasn't a bad guy. He wasn't a bad guy. That was the situation he found himself in. And in fact, we should look upon him as a Jew who accomplished many important things, even if, you know, things didn't work out the way that we would have liked them to have worked out. And again, sort of these different attitudes we'll see as we start looking in some of the sources about exactly how to view him. After the destruction of Jerusalem, he moves back. He moves to Rome. He's taken back to Rome, and that's where he lives the rest of his life. He never returns to Israel again. And it's at that point, living in Rome, that he writes all of these famous books, starting with Wars of the Jews. That's probably a book that is writing for the Roman government to show what exactly happened during the war. And the following writings of Antiquities of the Jews, the life, and against Appian, those seem to be things that he writes because he feels that they're important to write for other reasons. And so the first work is historical, but again, whenever you read it, you have to take into perspective that, well, he's writing it for the the Romans, and so maybe that colors what exactly he writes within it. And then the other writings, when we think about them, where he talks about the history of the Jews, he's living in Rome. So there's really two audiences that we try to keep in mind when he writes them. One is the Gentile audience, the pagan audience that he has in Rome, wanting to tell them, hey, don't think Jews are all rotten. Don't think that Judaism is some backward religion. It's very ancient. It's very old. It has a great history. In fact, let me tell you about history. Let me tell you how old it is. Let me tell you about its values. Let me tell you about the ideas that it contains, and so on. And so he's writing to them, or could be he's also writing to Jews that he sees in the diaspora, Jews who maybe he feels are knowledgeable about their Judaism, Jews who have assimilated or have lost their tradition. And so he's writing to them to teach them, to say, hey, I want you to find out what exactly Judaism is about. Yeah.
Is he an observant Jew in Rome, or does that concept exist of people living outside of Israel as being...
He identifies himself as one of the Perusian. I mean, I don't know. We don't know, but it seems that he does. That he certainly, whether he's a non-practicing Orthodox Jew, I don't know. But he certainly aligns himself with that movement. Okay? And just to sort of show you that, I want you to look at source number one. This is from Against Appian. This is one of the final book that he wrote. This was a defense of Judaism against anti-Semites that were coming across and were actively attacking Judaism. So here he writes, he says, I suppose that by my books of the antiquity of the Jews, most excellent Epaphroditus have made it evident to those who pursue them that our Jewish nation is a very great antiquity and had a distinct substance of its own originally. As also I've therein declared how we came to inhabit this country wherein we now live. Meaning talking about how we came to live in Israel. Those antiquities contain the history of 5,000 years and are taken out of our sacred books, but are translated by me into the Greek tongue. However, since I observe a considerable number of people giving ear to the reproaches that are laid against us by those who bear ill will to us, and will not believe what I've written concerning the antiquity of our nation, while they take it for a plain sign that our nation is of a late date, because they are not so much of vouchsafed to bear mention by the most famous historiographers among the Grecians. Meaning, I've already written a book. I've already written Antiquity Judaism. He's trying to explain, why am I writing another book sort of defending Judaism? So he says, I therefore have thought myself under an obligation to write somewhat briefly about these subjects in order to convict those that reproach us of spite and voluntary falsehood, and to correct the ignorance of others, and withal to instruct all those who are desirous of knowing the truth of what great antiquity we really are. And so from this book, you really get a sense, he is a very proud Jew. As much not thinking of him as a scoundrel, as a person who sort of sold the Jewish people up the river, he continued to maintain a very proud Jewish identity. And in fact, used his literary skills, his fame as a great author of that time, to teach people about Judaism, to try to win favor, a favorable opinion of Jews. And so while Antiquities focuses on Jewish law and Jewish history, here he gets a little bit more, and against Appian, a little bit more philosophical bent, where he tries to talk about the values and the ideals that's contained within Judaism. Okay. So that's the story. That's the story of Josephus. What I want to look at is, and again, you can read through his books to learn about the events, to learn about the stories that took place then, and it's a worthwhile read. To sort of find out about the history of that time period. It's not history necessarily so familiar with, and we sort of have a vague understanding of, Hanukkah and destruction of the Vajini, but there's a lot of intrigue, it was a real society with real people and real events that took place over many hundreds of years. And so there's a lot that he has there. What I want to do with the time that we have, really have a watch. What I want to do with the time that we have is to look through Josephus for the purpose of seeing what it contributes to Jewish learning. Again, to come at it from that vantage point to see, and again, I think the reason that I want to focus on that and not just talk about it in general is, let's see, of course, you could just take in college. Something you can just read through on your own. What I want to do is to look at Josephus from a unique perspective, perhaps in a way that even if we've studied Josephus before, we haven't had the opportunity to appreciate Josephus in this way, from a Judaic studies perspective. And so I want to do a number of different things as we talk about Josephus. You can see here on the outline is to go ahead and to look at Josephus for supporting evidence for somewhat almost far-fetched stories within the Gemara, and to look at that using Josephus, and this is sort of almost a common thing that we found last week, and we're going to continue to find out the use of this literature to help buttress or to help us appreciate the antiquity or the old age of Jewish practice as it's related within the Mishnah, within the Gemara. An old age for our traditions is how to interpret the Torah, and also to appreciate perhaps through reading the way that he expresses certain things, to appreciate also get a better understanding of, you know, what his goals were, what he was up against when he wrote what he did, and then ultimately to take a chance to look at when he wrote about Chorban Bayis, the destruction of the temple, because obviously it's important, but I think even more so, this time of year, reading in his words what took place, will, I took some of the more difficult passages that he wrote, will give you hopefully give you a pain you a little bit and add a little bit more to the sense of mourning that we have as we start in 3 weeks and looking towards the observance of Tisha B'Av. Okay. So what I want to do is I want to look at some sources we have in the Gemara, some fantastic stories, and then have a chance to take a look in Josephus. And during this time period where there's going to be a lot of reading involved, there's a lot of inside reading. Till now I've done a lot of me talking. Now we're going to have a chance to actually look at text inside. It's something that I want to encourage, that it's not just, these are not lectures, these are opportunities for study, for a chance for us to read. So don't get bored during the readings. Try to follow along inside so that you can stay engaged in what we're doing. The first source that we have over here, and I'll read perhaps the Hebrew sources, but I'm going to be asking some of you to volunteer to, now I was calling you, to volunteer to do some of the readings. Okay. So it says in source number 3, this is taken from the Gemara of Yoma. Yoma is actually a great misaf that deals with Yom, referring to Yom Kippur, the day of Day of Atonement. And in there we actually, because it deals so much of the discussion of Yom Kippur, is about the service that took place in the temple, which primarily was done in totality by the Kohanim. And so there's a lot of, in this Masechta of Yoma, lots of interesting stories, in fact, that it talks about that relate to Kohanim, and therefore specifically towards this time period of Bayit Sheni of the second temple period. And so there's a lot of interesting things there. So anyway, so it says over here, it says, and in fact, we're going to talk a little bit about this later, but this is partly a source from Megillat Tanit that we're going to be discussing in a couple weeks. But it says, Ba'asim mechamisha betevet yom hargrizimu. The 25th day of Tevet is the day of hargrizim. Whatever that means. Yom shebikshu kutiyim et beit elokeinu me Alexandrus mokdom. This is the day that the kutim, i.e., the Samaritans, i.e., the Shomronim, if you refer to them as Kutim, they'll be highly insulted. In fact, there is a Samaritan community that exists in Israel today. At the establishment of the State of Israel, there was about 100 of them. They were really almost all gone. What's his name? Ben Tzvi. He was, I think, made the first president of the State of Israel. What's his name? Yitzchak Ben Tzvi. He, in fact, took it upon himself to help rehabilitate this community, which we don't have to get into it too much. On one hand, it's a very beautiful humanitarian thing that he did, but historically, and so maybe it doesn't make them so much anymore, but historically they were major enemies. Their Jewish descent from the times of Bayit Rishon, of the first temple period, a breakaway sector, they would say, the original sect of Judaism. And not only was it just they were doing what they did, but in fact, there were actual civil wars, there were clashes, and at times where they helped the Romans, they facilitated our enemies, the Greeks, in battles against us, because there ultimately was a point where there was a break, in a sense, not just, you know, these are two sects of Judaism, in fact, this is a different religion. So they're referred to as Kutiim, Kuti, referring to a nation that existed that was a Gentile nation, and that we basically were saying, you're not Jews, you're really just Kutiim, that, you know, maybe among you are some descendants of Jews, but you've been so mixed with another faith that you're no longer even considered to be Jews. So they would not call themselves Kutiim, they call themselves Shomronim, proudly, but in Talmudic literature, they were referred to at that time by the Purushim, by the early rabbis of the Kutim. So it says that the Kutim went to Alexander Smokdon, Alexander of Macedon, we call him Alexander the Great, Hachrivo, Uvinatnu Lahem, that he gave them permission to destroy the temple, to destroy the Beit HaMikdash, and in fact, he gave them permission. That their request was granted. The reason they wanted to destroy it is because they say that where should the Beit HaMikdash be built? Not in Yerushalayim, not on the Temple Mount, but they say it should be built where? Hargrizim. They say it should be built in Shechem. That's where they say, that's where all the stories that we say about this is where the world was created from. This is where was Akedat Yitzchak. This is where Yaakov slept. This is where he had the dream. And so on. They say all that happened in Hargrizim. We say, we're talking about it happened in Yerushalayim. That's where the temples were built. So again, they requested, so again, you can see it was real conflict from Alexander the Great. So we're talking about the year 332 BCE as he's making his way down. He comes across from Greece through Turkey, down along the coast, and ultimately on his way down to conquer Egypt before going back up and then moving eastward as he ultimately moves all the way, goes all across the Middle East, even into the Far East, into India. So he's passing through the area of Israel in 332 BCE. And it says that at that point they approach him and they ask for it. So, Bo Vaho Dio at Shimon HaTzadik. So the people came and they told Shimon HaTzadik, he was the Kohen Gadol, to say, hey, Shimon HaTzadik, look what's happening. So Ma'asa, what did he do? It says, Lavash Bigdei Kuna, that he wore the garb of the Kohanim, v'nilatei Bigdei Kuna, u'mikirei mi'ikari Yisrael imo, he went with a delegation of the most respected Jews. V'ahuko cho'or v'yadeyan, and they took torches of fire, v'chol alay l'halu hochem itzadzeh, v'halu hochem itzadzeh, atcha alu amal ha'shachar. The whole night, they went on their way to see him. As they were going, they finally started to get into the eyesight of Alexander. So Amar Lahemi Halalu, he said to the people that were with him, who are these people coming towards us? So Amrulo, he said to him, Yehudim Shemar Duba, these are the Jews that have rebelled against you. They have not accepted you. They reached the city of Antipatris, otherwise known as Caesarea. And at that point, they came into contact with one another. Kaven Shira'a l'Shimon HaTzadik. As soon as Alexander the Great saw Shimon HaTzadik, Yarev Mimerkav Tovi Shtachav Elefanov, he got off of his chariot and he bowed down to the Kohen Gadol. He bowed down to Shimon HaTzadik. Amru Lo, the people that were with him, said to him, Melech Gadol Kamotchai Shtachav Eliyudizeh, a great person as you, a great king as you, you're bowing down to this lowly Jew? What are you doing? So Amalam Dimuti Yogno Shalzeb Minat Sakat of the Fanai Beit Milchamti. He says, the face of this guy appears to me every day before I go to battle in a dream. So Amar Lahem Lama Batem, meaning he says, I always get this prophecy, and it's always this old man. I don't know who he is, but this old man comes to me in a dream every day before I go to battle and tells me, you're going to be successful when you go to battle. And so as soon as I saw this guy, I bowed down right away. So Amru Lo, so Amar Lahem Lamabat, and said, why come? So Amru, Ebshar, Beit, Shemipalim, Bo, Lacha, Baal, Mahutcha, Shalote, Charev, Yitavacha, Goyim, Lacharivo. Is it possible that in the place where they pray for your success, meaning in the temple, the Beit HaMikdash, that you're going to give permission for Gentiles to destroy it, to let Kutim come and destroy it? Amar Lahem, he said, Mihalalu, he says, who's going to do that? Kutim halalu she'om v'fanach. It says, ah, this guy's right next to you, right? It's like the story of Purim. It's like the guy right there, this guy standing right next to you. So Amar Lama Rehem Basurim Biyadchem said, fine, take them as you will. He gave the kutim into their hands. And in fact, as the story goes, that they killed those kutim that had tried to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. It's a crazy story. I mean, if you think about it, Adam is great at bowing down to the Kohen Gadol. Seems like a fantasy, perhaps part of our tradition, you know, about what happened, but almost somewhat fantastic. Surprisingly, we find a very similar story in Josephus. I'll ask somebody to read this. This is taken from Antiquities. He goes through the more expanded version of Jewish history. Would somebody please... thank you. Sure, source number four. Source number four. Okay, we have a volunteer. Thank you.
But Sanballat thought he had now gotten the proper opportunity to make his attempt. So he renounced Darius, and taking with him 7,000 of his own subjects, he came to Alexander. And finding him beginning the siege of Tyre, he said to him that he delivered up to him these men who came out of places under his dominion, and he gladly accept him for his lord instead of Darius.
Darius is the Persian. Is the Persian emperor that Alexander is going to be warring with. So he says, listen, we're going to help support you against Darius, in order that you can be successful.
So when Alexander had received him kindly, Sanballat thereupon took courage and spoke to him about his present affair. He told him that he had a son-in-law, Manasseh, who was brother to the high priest Jaddua, and that there were many others of his own nation now with him that were desirous to have the temple in the place the subject to him, that it would be for the king's advantage to have the strength of the Jews divided into two parts, lest when the nation is of one mind and united upon any attempt for innovation it prove troublesome to kings, as it had formerly proved to the kings of Assyria. Whereupon Alexander gave Sanballat leave so to do, who used the utmost diligence and built the temple, and made Manasseh the priest, and deemed it a great reward that his daughter's children should have that dignity. But when the 7 months of the siege of Tyre were over, and the 2 months of the siege of Gaza, Sanballat died. Now Alexander, when he had taken Gaza, made haste to go up.
Moving down the coast, right? Tyre is in Lebanon, and he's moving, now he's down in Gaza.
And Jaddua the priest, when he heard that, was in agony, and under terror of not knowing how he should meet the Macedonians, since the king was displeased at his foregoing disobedience. He therefore ordained that the people should make supplication, and should join with him in offering sacrifice to God, whom he besought to protect that nation, and to deliver them from the perils that were coming upon them.
I'll just say, Jaddua is, according to Josephus, the person who was the Kohen Gadol at the time period of Alexander the Great. He doesn't identify it as Shimon HaTzadik. He identifies it as somebody by the name of Jaddua, who, according to Josephus, is the grandfather of Shimon HaTzadik. Okay.
Whereupon God warned him in a dream, which came upon him after he had offered sacrifice, that he should take courage and adorn the city and open the gates, that the rest should appear in white garments, but that he and the priest should meet the king in the habits proper to their order, without the dread of any ill consequences, which the providence of God would prevent. Upon which, when he rose from his sleep, he greatly rejoiced, and declared to all the warning he had received from God, according to which dream he acted entirely, and so waited for the coming of the king. And when he understood that he was not far from the city, he went out in procession with the priests and the multitude of the citizens.
Right, the city being, according to Josephus, somewhat Yerushalayim, that Alexander has come to Yerushalayim.
The procession was venerable, and the manner of it different from that of other nations. Alexander, when he saw the multitude at a distance in white garments, while the priests were clothed with fine linen, and the high priest in purple and scarlet clothing, with his mitre on his head, having the golden plate whereon the name of God was engraved, he approached by himself and adored that name, and first saluted the high priest. The Jews also did it of the Jews also did all together with one voice salute Alexander, and encompassed him about, whereupon the kings of Syria and the rest were surprised for what Alexander had done, and supposed him disordered in his mind. However, Parmenio alone went up to him, and asked him how it came to pass that when all others adored him, he should adore the high priest of the Jews. To whom he replied, I did not adore him, but that God who has honored him with his high priesthood. For I saw this very person in a dream, in this very habit, when I was at Dios in Macedonia, who, when I was considering with myself how I might obtain the dominion of Asia, exhorted me to make no delay, but boldly to pass over the sea, for that he would conduct my army, and would give me the dominion over the Persians. Therefore, having seen no other in that habit, and now seeing this person in it, and remembering that vision and the exhortation which I had in my dream, I believe that I bring this army under the divine conduct, and shall therefore conquer Darius, and destroy the power of the Persians, and that all things will succeed according to what is in my mind. And when he had said this to Parmenio, and had given the high priest his right hand, the priest ran along by him, and he came into the city. And when he went up into the temple, he offered sacrifice to God, according to the high priest's direction, and magnificently treated both the high priest and the priest. And when the book of Daniel was showed him, wherein Daniel declared that one of the Greeks should destroy the empire of the Persians, he supposed that himself was the person intended, and he was then glad. He dismissed the multitude for the present, but the next day he called them to him and did them ask what favors they pleased of him, whereupon the high priest desired that they might enjoy the laws of their forefathers and might pay no tribute on the seventh year.
Shemitah.
He granted all their desires.
Okay, so you have over here, there are some differences, which in fact almost give it greater weight, but it's the same story. It's the same story with that you find within the Talmud. And so the Talmud, story written many years later, has additional support within Josephus. I mean, clearly already many hundreds of years before the Gemara is written, you already have a source that tells this same story. And almost the differences help give it greater veracity, because it means that the Gemara didn't simply look at Josephus and copy it. I mean, the fact that they had somewhat almost an independent tradition of this story gives it a greater sense of the historicity of, in fact, some type of event taking place between the Kohen Gadol, whoever it was, and Alexander the Great, regardless of whether it's taking place in what will be Caesarea or it's taking place in Yerushalayim, that there was some type of event that took place, and that the Jews did find favor with Alexander the Great. And perhaps, as the stories relate, that in fact Alexander the Great recognized the Kohen Gadol as a holy man. Yes?
Isn't it possible that Josephus, being a Kohen, knew the oral tradition? When we say the Talmud, we're talking now about something that's been written down. Mm-hmm. He already may have known the story and what was the oral tradition at the time that was being done, before it was written down, which was written down after Josephus, let's presume.
Yeah.
But the oral tradition was present before Josephus, and therefore he just extracted that story from what he had known as the oral tradition.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, there's questions as far as, this different, you can find different academic articles where they talk about this and try to figure out, where did Josephus get this from, and were the other documents, perhaps, that he had used as the basis for his writing of the story. But clearly, it's a very ancient story, and when he's writing it down, it's maybe 300 years after the story, but meaning it's within the same framework, meaning it was within the same, meaning there wasn't like living in a different land where you can say traditions are broken down or whatever. It was within the same country where the story had taken place. The fact that he writes it does give the credibility that, okay, whether it happened exactly that way or happened a different way, something did happen, in fact, and that this incredible story of the Talmud, in fact, likely did occur in some form or another. Yeah.
On the other side, you could say that Josephus obviously survived from from the time that he wrote it till now, perhaps some of the texts were stories that were known in Babel because of the fact that he wrote them.
It could be, but again, the fact that there's important changes, the name of the Kohen Gadol, the city that it takes place, would make it sound like it must be an independent story. Because if I was the Gemara and I wanted to make a change, I'm not going to change it from Yerushalayim to Caesarea. If anything, you want to make it happen in Yerushalayim. So the changes are significant and give it, you know, the sense that there is a great, you know, there was a tradition, and in fact, there had been an encounter between the Kohen Gadol and Alexander the Great. Yeah, Barry.
Is there any reference in the Gemara at all to Josephus directly?
No, not that I know. Not that I know. So maybe they weren't reading him. You know, it could be that I don't know that, and I don't know that they were. I assume that they weren't reading Josephus. That's probably more likely. Okay. Let's go on. I want to maybe we'll go back to this next one, but I want to just skip forward to the source that we have in on page 5, source number 7. 7 on the left side. Here we have a famous Gemara. It's an important Gemara as we again look towards Tisha B'Av, but it tells of a very important event that takes place right before Korban HaBayis. It takes place during the siege of Yerushalayim. And again, and it tells this incredible story, which again, we take for granted, but when you take a step back and you think of, you know, if someone who didn't necessarily have trust in the Gemara read the story, they would say, yeah, right. So in fact, it's an amazing story, and I want to look then and see, you know, if there's anything in Josephus that maybe tells us one way or another about the historicity of this event. So this is talking about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was the greatest rabbi alive at the time of the destruction of the temple. And so the story goes as follows. It says, Kimata lahasam, that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai went to see Titus. Now, we know in the story, in the Gemara, I cut it out over here, the whole story, how he's able to get through the siege. No one was being allowed to leave. He pretended to be dead. They took him out in a coffin. He got out of the walls. And then he went and he goes to the general of the Romans. He goes to Titus, who at that point he goes to Vespasian, excuse me, who is the general of the Roman legion, which is attacking Yerushalayim. So it says, Kimata lahasam, he reached there, Amar Shalma Alach Malka. He says, peace to you, O king, O emperor. Shalma Alach Malka, peace to you, O emperor. Amar Lei. So Vespasian says to Michayevet Shrei Katla, he says, you have brought upon yourself the death penalty for two reasons. You should be killed twice. Chada, first of all, de la malka ana, but kakariat li malka. He says, first of all, you've just called me the emperor, and I'm not the emperor. He goes, you should get killed for that. The two, furthermore, imalka ana, he says, if I really am the emperor, ata ina my loasis legabe, what took you so long? Right? Why didn't you do come till now? So, darned if you do, darned if you don't. Right? He says, I should kill you. So, Amar Lei, Dika Amart Lav Malka Ani. He says, that which you have said, that you are not a king, Ibra Malka At. He says, you will be a king. Ilav Malka At, Lo Mimsero Yushalayim Biadech. Because if you were not, in fact, the emperor, Jerusalem would not be able to fall into your hands. And the fact that Jerusalem will fall into your hands is a sign that you are destined to be the emperor. And this that you said, if you are really the emperor, why have I not come to you till now? He says, you know that there are the zealots in Jerusalem that are not letting anybody leave, and that's why I wasn't able to come to you until this point. So Adhahi Asa Priskasa Allah Miromi. At that point a message came from Rome, and Amri Lay, they said to him, Kum, get up, Demit Lay Caesar, the Caesar has died, the Emperor of Rome has died, Vamri Hanu Hashibi Diromi, Losivka Bereshe, and the important ones of Rome, meaning the Senate of Rome, has appointed you to be the new emperor. So Amar Lei, they said to him, He said to me, "Achar dechach mitu kulei hayad ina amaylo asisu legabai." Again, Vespasian says, "If you are so wise, wow, you knew what was going to happen before it happened. Why didn't you come to me until now?" Responds, "Amar lei velo arachlai." He said, "He's already told you. I couldn't get out." So Amar lei ananami amri la Amar lei meizalzina veinish achrina bishadarna elabai minai miadi da asan la. So he says to him, he goes, "Tell me, what do you want?" He says, "What do you want? What do you want? Someone else is going to come and take my place. What do you want me to give to you?" So Amar lei tainli yavna bechachamaha. Very important request that he made that perhaps allowed for the survival of the Jewish people, survival of the Jewish tradition. He says, "I know you're going to destroy Jerusalem, but give me a safe haven. Allow me to establish a community in Yavne where I can go with my students, with the other sages, and the Jewish religion can continue to stay alive." Shulte Rav Gamliel, he says, "Give me the cure for Rav Gamliel, one of the great rabbis." Basvasa the Nasai and Leila Rabbi Tzadok. Give me the descendants of Rabbi Gamliel. Rabbi Gamliel was the Nasi, and in fact, for many generations later, you have Shimon ben Gamliel, then Gamliel ben Shimon, and then Shimon ben Gamliel. It goes on for a bunch of generations between Gamliel and Shimon, and so in the literature, you'll see Gamliel the first, Gamliel the second, Gamliel the third, and so on. And so he says, "I want to maintain the Nasiut." It was important because the tradition was that the Nasiut came; they were the lineage of King David, and so he was preparing, he was maintaining the survival of ultimately King David, of meaning Mashiach, the Messiah. And then he says also of Asvasa the Messiah, and Rabbi Tzadok, and the cure for Rabbi Tzadok. The treatment for him because he's been sick. So Kari Le Rabbi Yosef, Yitem Rabbi Akiva, Meshiv Chachamim Machor V'Daita Misakel. They are recalled. They said referring to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, they quoted the verse that said that sometimes the wise do stupid things. Why? They should have said, he should have requested, save Jerusalem. Don't destroy Jerusalem. Don't destroy the temple. Why didn't he ask for that? So, Husavar, Mazrin, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai determined that Dilma Kule Hailo Abid, he would have given that. That's too much to request. But teleport to Nami Lohavi. If I ask him that, he won't give me anything. So let me ask for something small, and at least I'll get that.
That's a Jewish answer, like somebody else could have gotten a better bargain.
So in any case, right? So he said no. He says that's not going to happen. So in any case, this fabulous story, right? About this prophecy that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had, that he knew. That Vespasian was going to ultimately become the emperor, right? It's a crazy story. So let's read what Josephus has to say. Josephus was captured, as we said, by the Romans, and the story takes place upon his capture. This is in Wars of the Jews, where he's really going through in detail those events. Would somebody please read? There's someone in the room. Okay, thank you, Audrey.
When Josephus heard him give those...
Just started the line up.
Sorry.
That's okay.
However, Vespasian gave strict orders that he should be kept with great caution, as though he would, in a very little time, send him to Nero. When Josephus heard him give those orders, he said that he had somewhat in his mind that he would willingly save to himself alone. When therefore they were all ordered to withdraw, excepting Titus and two of their friends, he said, "Thou, O Vespasian, thinkest no more that thou hast taken Josephus himself captive, but I come to thee as a messenger of greater tidings. For had not I been sent by God to thee, I knew what was the law of the Jews in this case, and how it becomes generals to die. Dost thou send me to Nero? For why? Are Nero's successors till they come to thee still alive? Thou, O Vespasian, art Caesar and emperor, thou and this thy son. Bind me now still faster and keep me for thyself. For thou, O Caesar, art not only lord over me, but over the land and the sea and all mankind. And certainly I deserve to be kept in closer custody than I now am in order to be punished, if I rashly affirm anything of God. When he had said this, Vespasian at present did not believe him, but supposed that Josephus said this as a cunning trick in order to his own preservation. But in a little time he was convinced and believed what he said to be true, God himself erecting his expectations so as to think of obtaining the empire, and by other signs foreshowing his advancement. He also found Josephus to have spoken truth on other occasions. For one of those friends that were present at that secret conference said to Josephus, I cannot but wonder how thou couldst not foretell to the people of Jotapata that they should be taken, nor couldst foretell this captivity which hath happened to thyself, unless what thou now sayest be a vain thing in order to avoid the rage that is risen against thyself. To which Josephus replied, I did foretell to the people of Jotapata that they would be taken on the 47th day, and that I should be caught alive by the Romans. Now when Vespasian had inquired of the captives privately about those predictions, he found them to be true, and then he began to believe those that concerned himself. Yet he did not set Josephus at liberty from his hands, but bestowed upon him suits of clothes and other precious gifts. He treated him also in a very obliging manner, and continued so to do. Titus still joining his interest, ill the honors that were done to him.
And so again, obviously the story is recounted somewhat differently, that the hairbringer of this, or the messenger of this prophecy, isn't Yochanan ben Zakkai, but is in fact Josephus. That he is the prophet, he is the one who has the Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit, or whatever, however we understand it, that knows what's going to happen. So I don't know. But again, we look at the story in the Gemara, and you know, it sounds wild. You find it in Josephus also. You find that, you know, something did happen. There was somehow some knowledge within the Jewish community. Maybe Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is the one who had said it, and maybe ultimately it was Josephus who said it to them. I don't know. I don't know the whole story. Our tradition says that it was Yochanan ben Zakkai himself. But clearly there was some type of misora, some type of tradition, that in fact Vespasian would in fact become the emperor. And this was at some point said over to Vespasian, and as this story recounts, as is the story in the Gemara, that was something he appreciated. He appreciated that prophecy, or that message being shared with him, and because of that he gave gifts. He gave Josephus clothing, he gave Yochanan Zakkai the city of Yavne. Yeah.
Wouldn't the first story is set a long time before Josephus writing it, so the people didn't have contemporaneous real knowledge of in fact all the details. The second story, though, Josephus is writing to an audience or people who could read it, who in fact were contemporaneous to the time, or maybe even participant in that. So they would have, if he was making fancy that had no real relationship to him, they would have said something, or he would have.
Yeah, so
it
it is possible that maybe Josephus, again, so what's possible is that maybe in fact this was not something that Josephus came up with, but maybe within the Jewish community there was a sense, you know, maybe the leaders of the community had said this, and Josephus, you know, simply had heard it and, you know, and used it to his advantage. And that doesn't necessarily deny the fact that at a later time, when maybe Yochanan ben Zakkai went to him and told him this prophecy, and he says, you know, it's really going to happen, and then it happened on the spot, that maybe that, you know, brought about Vespasian to say, hey, you know what, you know, this rabbi got it on the moment, you know, I'm going to give him, you know, something, you know, whatever he desires. But again, sort of seeing it in Josephus gives the story, I think greater credibility, even though he gives it in a, you know, slightly different form, or in a different form, but at least this idea that there was some kind of prophecy about Vespasian, had happened during that time. So I think that's important. okay, so that's just two examples. You can look at the other one that's quoted over there, that sort of talks about some stories that took place, and sort of corroborating even the slightly different story within Josephus. It gives, again, a sense that stories that we have in the Gemara that we sometimes think, you know, they're fantastic or whatever, that, you know what, those stories really did take place. And I think sort of reading these stories in Josephus can help, at least for me it does, gives me a greater... maybe without ever writing anything on its own, I should simply trust what the Gemara says, but certainly this continues to give greater faith within the stories of the Gemara, as we find that many of their stories, some of the wildest ones, are found in other sources as well. At least for me, it gives me even greater confidence within our Masorah, within our tradition, within our Agadic tradition, in addition to perhaps our Halakhic tradition as well. What I want to look at now that we've sort of seen some of the history parts of Josephus, which I think are interesting, I want to move now and talk a little bit about some perhaps of the halakhic things that we see from Josephus. So we saw at the beginning that Josephus writes that he was a knowledgeable Jew, that he aligned himself with the Pharisees, and there's a lot of discussion as to whether that's in fact true. So I want to look at some sources that sort of talk about that. Before we look at those sources, I want to first look at a source that discusses the Pharisees. It's interesting to sort of see how he describes the Perushim, how he describes those people that we consider ourselves to be ultimately coming from, to be coming within their tradition. And so it's worthwhile to sort of see what he says or how he defines what he identifies as this is Perushi belief. This is what the Pharisees believe in. So that's on page 7. Source 9. Okay, so here he says, what I would now explain is this, that the Pharisees have delivered to the people a great many observances by succession from their fathers, which are not written in the laws of Moses. What's he referring to? The Torah Shebaalpeh, the oral tradition, right? It's not found in the laws of Moses. It's not found within the five books of Moses, but they have a tradition that this is what the laws are. And for that reason, it is that the Sadducees reject them, the Tzedukim, the Sadducees, and say that we are to esteem those observances to be obligatory, which are in the written word, but are not to observe what are derived from the tradition of our forefathers. Right? The Tzedukim rejected the tradition. They said, read what it says in the Bible, that's what it is that we're supposed to do. And concerning these things, it is that great disputes and differences have arisen among them, that while the Sadducees are able to persuade none but the rich, and have not the populace obsequious to them, but the Pharisees have the multitude on their side. And so he describes a picture that the Tzedukim, and we'll talk about them more next week when we talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls, that the Tzedukim had perhaps some of the elite, shall we say, of the community, the wealthy, the aristocracy of the Jewish people, but the Perushim really had what's referred to in the Talmud, the Am Ha'aretz. They had the people, they had the multitudes followed after the tradition of the Perushim. Yes?
Yeah, I mean, actually, isn't it true that the Tzedukim were the Kohanim, the largest?
Yes, it is. It is. And we'll have a chance to talk a little bit more about that. But yeah, they are the Kohanim, and that's what I sort of go back to earlier when we spoke about that. You know, when he says he's from aristocracy, he's from the Kohanim, because typically the Kohanim were the aristocracy. They were the rich. They were the ones in the temple. They were the ones who had that power. And so he says, you know, that's all the Tzedukim are. They're just those people. Clearly not all the Kohanim aligned themselves with that movement. There were many Kohanim who continued to align themselves and to follow the tradition, as he says, of our forefathers, to follow the position of the rabbis, of the Perushim. And so when he refers to the Perushim, he's referring to the sages, but the followers of the sages are the Am Ha'aretz, as referred to in the Gemara, who maybe themselves are not as knowledgeable, but that is the approach that they try to follow. Again, if anything, we'll call them, right, the unobserving Orthodox, right? They follow the Perushim, whether or not they necessarily themselves are so knowledgeable and necessarily really are so careful about all the details of the laws. But clearly, he recognizes the Perushim. He identifies them as the major political force, at least at that time. As we're going to talk about, there's a lot of different forces at that time, but he's identifying at least the masses as following the Perushim, and that's who he aligns himself with as well. In fact, he says, as a child, he became very knowledgeable within those areas of law. So what's interesting to see is that in certain parts of his writings, particularly in Antiquities of the Jews, when he's going through the stories of the Bible, he also at certain points talks about our laws. And it's interesting to see what he writes Jewish law was. And then to compare it to see what we have in our sources as well. And so I want to start with some Pesukim, and then we'll look at some verses, and then we'll look at what Josephus says. So it says, and these are both taken from chapter 21 in the book of Exodus, and Sefer Shemos, where it says, Makeh ish umet mochima, that a person who strikes someone and that person dies, that the one who has done that act, they themselves are killed for it. That person receives the death penalty for having murdered somebody. It then says later on, V'chi yirivun anashim, that if two people are fighting, V'hakeh ish et re'ehu be'even o be'egrov, and one strikes the other, V'lo yimot, and he will, does not die, V'nafal l'mishkav, and he lies on his bed. Im yakum v'italech b'chutz al mishanto, if he gets up, if he becomes healed, and he goes about his way, V'nakeh ha'makeh, that the one who has carried out this act will be cleansed. Rak shifto yitain v'rapo yirapay. Simply will have to pay some damages for what has transpired, but he will not be put to death. The person will have not died. And we don't employ the death penalty for attempted murder. We only employ the death penalty for someone who, in fact, does carry out a murder. What I want to do now is look in Josephus. I want to ask you if you notice anything different or odd. Okay? So this is in Antiquities of the Jews. So this is source number 12. He says, in a fight without use of the blade, if one be stricken and die on the spot, he shall be avenged by a like fate for him that struck him. Right? Makeh ish umet mot yumat. Right, he shall kill the one who has tried to kill someone. But if he be carried home and lies sick for several days before he dies, he that struck shall go unpunished. However, if he recover and has spent much of on his doctoring, the other shall pay all that he has expended during the time of his confinement to his couch and all that he has given to the physicians. And so, what do you see over here? Did anything strike you in what he says?
He says, if he be carried home and lies sick for several days before he dies, he that struck shall go unpunished.
Right, and so that's surprising because
the guy dies.
The guy dies, and so he's saying, as long as it's not immediate, as long as it's not on the spot, that's okay, right? The person is you're not killed for what takes place, and that seems odd. And so that's what I talk about. You know, some scholars, I have an article that I've been reading about this, but some scholars look at this and say, it goes to show you Josephus was not the biggest Talmud Chacham, right? He really, he wasn't. He claimed to be so knowledgeable, but he said he was knowledgeable because, he went to, he had a basic Jewish education, but he really wasn't so knowledgeable. So he heard different things, and he sort of put it together. He's living in Rome now. He wrote this together, and this is what he wrote. I mean, this is what he felt, but he was confused. He doesn't know exactly what Judaism really believes. And okay, he's clearly knowledgeable about Jewish law, but he doesn't really know Jewish law at the end of the day. And so there's a debate among scholars whether that's the case. In this particular article that I was reading, written by a professor, David Goldenberg, I don't know who he is exactly, with my lack of knowledge, but he writes in this article that he in fact wants to defend, and he in fact wants to show that the law that Josephus is writing is in fact maybe not in what was started, a term that was coined in the 19th century, is not something that we find in the Mosaic law, right? This is, again, those who look are sort of disparaging our tradition of Torah Shel Peh, but they say that maybe what you would find in Mosaic law, meaning by just a literal reading of the biblical verse, but if you look into the writings of Chazal, into the writings of our sages, you look into the Mishnah, you look into the Talmud, in fact, you find this law, and Josephus did know what he was talking about. And the people who said that Josephus didn't know what he was talking about, they're the Amorites. Right? They're the one who doesn't know what they're talking about. So what I'm going to do is look at a source, and we'll see that it's not exactly what Josephus is saying, but it could be maybe that's what Josephus was trying to get at. So let's looking at a Tosefta. Again, this is one of the classes we'll have next year in Sfarim Bashana, exactly what the Tosefta is. But for all intents and purposes, it's the Mishnah. And we'll see. Yeah, Susan.
Is there a fine point that I'm missing between and shall cause him to be thoroughly healed versus all he has given to the physician?
Where are you looking?
The last line in 18.
Yeah.
Tells you what he's responsible for paying, and he and pays for lots of his time.
Yeah.
And shall cause him to be thoroughly healed.
Right.
To me, it sounds like he's responsible to make sure that he is attended to. Whereas in the Josephus book last line, it says the other shall pay all that he has expended during the time of his confinement to his couch and all that he has given to the physicians. Is there a fine point that I am missing?
No, I think they're basically saying you have to pay. You have to pay all the medical bills. I think they're both saying you got to pay all the medical expenses, whatever is necessary. So again, I'm not saying that you're not right to the degree, you know, how much to what point you have to pay them. Could be there's more of a discussion and research that particular issue.
No, I'm just
but
saying, does he have to make sure the man is attended to by doctors, or is he only responsible to pay him?
Oh no, I don't know that. It means you have to pay, meaning, I think there's an assumption the person's going to need doctors, and you have to pay for it. You have to pay for
yeah,
it.
I think it's a fault of the translation. They are trying to translate for Yerapay, which is a kind of a
double
literary language form.
Yeah, right.
And so they are giving it extra interpretation, saying that means...
She's wondering, does he have to force him to get medical attention?
Yeah,
or I think it's the same thing. I think it's just getting caught on a fun point. Yeah.
I mean, in the Hebrew, that's all I'm saying.
Yeah, okay.
It's not
yeah.
We have, through the whole Gemara, of rabbis arguing with each other about what their tradition was.
Okay.
So to say that he's completely wrong about something, he may have had another tradition that came down.
So some say that. So some say that the things we find in Josephus are evidence of a tradition that was lost. Again, we're going to talk about more next week when we talk about Dead Sea Scrolls, that there were different sects of Jews, and maybe Josephus was simply adopting another position, or a position that was lost. That's a possibility also.
Well,
that's a possibility also.
He predates the Mishnah.
Absolutely, he definitely predates.
So this shows that this discussion has gone on 150 years before the Mishnah was written.
Yes, thank you. So we have a Yerushalmi who's helping us out over here, a former Rochesterian. So I thank you for that. And that's exactly going to be the point. And so keep that in mind, or I'm going to get to that after we look at the source. About, again, sort of looking at the age of our tradition. So look what it says. This is the Tosefta over here in Source 13. And it says, Hameka et chaveru v'amdu l'mita. If you strike your friend and it's determined that he is going to die, you can still, depending on what happens, you can then say, no, he's going to live. L'chaim, if you identify he's going to live, you can't go ahead and say, no, he's going to die. Meaning, once a judgment is rendered, this person will survive. You can't change the judgment and say, in fact, they will die. Meaning, and you'll get the death penalty. Amdu lemita, if in fact they determined he would die, chayiv mita, then if he dies, you will be liable for the death penalty. Upater min hamomin, and you won't pay any financial, meaning, you only get one punishment. You're either killed or you pay. So it says you're going to get killed, right? This is a rule within the Gemara that a person only gets punished for one thing. Amdu l'mamon, if they decide no, he has to pay money, meaning the person will survive. Then chayiv mamon. Then in that situation, even the person ultimately dies, all you pay is money, upater mihamita, but you do not get the death penalty. Amdu lemita, v'kelim ashay omdin oto v'mamon, if they decide that he was going to die, and then he got better, at that point, you pay his financial damages. The Tosefta continues, is amdu lechayim, umet, if they determined that he would live, and then he dies. Mishalem, he pays nezek, v'tsa'ar, ripoy, sheves, uboshe. So this is in the Gemara, there's five things that you have to pay for. You know, we saw in the Bible, one line over there, in fact, there's five things that you have to pay for. When we talk about damages, you have to pay for the damage, you have to pay for what you did, you have to pay for the pain. Right? This is important to think about legal things, about things that in our legal code we make you pay for. You have to pay for pain, you have to pay for the medical expenses, you have to pay for his loss of employment, and you have to pay for embarrassment. Right? You have to pay for all of these things. Okay? And who do you pay it to if he's dead? Liorshim, right? You pay it to his heirs. Amdu lemita, if they decide, you know, he's gonna die. Vehekel mimaja haya. And he starts to get better. The hichbid, and then his condition worsens. Umate, and he dies. Omdinoto. Then we have to figure out. Imate machmat hamake harishona. If he ultimately dies from that original wound, harezachayev. Then the person's liable with the death penalty. Vim lav. But if not, if we say no, this is a secondary thing, maybe. I don't know exactly how it determines he gets a later infection, but it's not from that original wound. Hareza pator. The person does not get the death penalty. From Nehemiah, all member of Nehemiah was in the position, afilu meit machmat macha rishona pater, that no, once a person starts to get a little bit better, even if afterwards their condition worsens because of that original wound, the person does not get the death penalty anymore. And so here you have a discussion within the rabbinic literature about a person that has a delayed death, meaning a person, not just simply delayed, not simply they got hit and they got worse and worse and worse and eventually died 5 days later, but a person who was hit started to get better and then got worse and then passed away. And then in that situation, the person is exempt. The person is not killed. And so some suggest that maybe that's really what Josephus means when he has that line, where he has that statement where he says that if he be carried home and lies sick for several days before he dies, that you go unpunished. He's not simply saying Allah, it's not immediate, you don't get the death penalty. He's saying the person went home for a few days, he started to get better, and then he died, that's when he's not punishable. It could be that's in fact what Josephus was saying. It could be that no, that's not what Josephus is saying, and he had a different tradition. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that no, what Josephus is saying is, in fact, this law of the Tosafta. If that's true, it's a support to show that this law of the Tosafta wasn't something the rabbis sort of figured out, you know, hundreds of years later, but in fact it's something that was already the practice, it already was that tradition of our, of our forefathers that Josephus himself referred to, that already existed hundreds of years before. So how far back does it go? You could say, oh, it goes back to the times of Josephus. Or you could say, no, it goes back all the way, you know, to the oral tradition that we have. So whether you can't prove that from Josephus, but you can prove at least it goes back, it predates the Mishnah, predates the Gemara, and once you go back that far, let's go back all the way, right? Let's go back to Har Sinai. So right, that's a question. But in fact, it is important to sort of see evidence within earlier writings. This is one of the reasons why these writings from Bayit Sheni are so important, is because in fact we can use them as evidence. Again, we have our belief, we know what we believe regardless of anything else, but in fact we can look at them as a support for the things that we believe in for our tradition. For that reason, it's important. Okay, I want to now conclude. We sort of looked at Josephus, we got a chance to know Josephus, the person, his life experiences, sort of got a chance to know him. Yes, a proud Jew. Did he do something wrong during the war? Who knows? Maybe. That's what his book, The Life, is about. His life is a book, we said, is a defense. It was with those who accused him of wrongdoings during the war. He's a complicated person. It's hard to ever know. But it seems he certainly was proud of being a Jew. And in addition to that, we can learn a lot about certain things about our tradition based on stories that he relates that we find within our tradition, based on laws that he relates we find in our tradition, that gives us a sense of the age, of the truthfulness of the Masorah, of the tradition that has been preserved for us within the Mishnayot, within the Gemara. In addition to that, ultimately, the way Josephus is known in the broader world is that of a historian. Again, his historian status is questioned, whether he was really a good historian, whether he was just a great writer and just caught people's attention. Perhaps he was both. Perhaps he was some of both. But as Jews, what's particularly penetrating are his recollections of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. So I want to conclude by reading those. And really, that's how we'll end. It's not an exciting way to end, but I think it's an important something for us to take with us as we are now find ourselves within the 3 weeks. Would somebody please read? Okay. Source 14.
For all hope of escaping was now cut off from the Jews, together with their liberty of going out of the city. Then to extend and widen its progress and devour the people by whole houses and families. The upper rooms were full of women and children that were dying by famine, and the lanes of the city were full of the dead bodies of the aged. The children also and the young men wandered about the marketplaces like shadows, all filled with the famine, and fell down dead wheresoever their misery seized them. As for burying them, those that were sick themselves were not able to do it, and those that were hearty and well were deterred from doing it by the great multitude of those dead bodies, and by the uncertainty there with how soon they should die themselves. For many died as they were burying others, and many went to their coffins before that fatal hour would come. Nor was there any lamentations made under these calamities, nor were heard any mournful complaints. The famine confounded all natural passions, for those who were just going to die looked upon those that were gone to rest before them with dry eyes and open mouths. A deep silence also, and a kind of deadly night, had seized upon the city.
Yeah,
quite a more
pretty awful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Someone read the last verse.
And then attacked the Romans again, when those that guarded the holy house fought with those that quenched the fire that was burning in the inner court of the temple. But these Romans put the Jews to flight and proceeded as far as the holy house itself.
Right, the temple.
At which time one of the soldiers, without staying for any orders and without any concern or dread upon him, at so great an undertaking, and being hurried on by a certain divine fury, snatched somewhat out of the material that were on fire, and being lifted upon another soldier, he set fire to the golden window, through which there was a passage to the rooms that were round about the holy house on the north side of it. As the flames went upward, the Jews made a great clamor, such as so mighty an affliction requires, ran together to prevent it. And now they spare not their lives any longer, nor suffered anything to restrain their force, since the holy house was